Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Songs in the key of whale. This is Soundcheck, and you can call me John Schaefer. In the next hour, we'll look at music produced by the world's largest mammal, and Soundcheck CD picks of the week, and violinist James Ennis closes out our Center Street tenure with a live performance. But first, in the late 60s, two scientists did something no one had done before. They dropped a waterproof microphone over the side of a boat into the sea and stumbled across the humpback whale song, an example of which you're hearing now. In a moment, we will speak with one of those scientists whose recordings helped kick off the eco movement. But first, jazz musician and author David Rothenberg. He spent the better part of a year on boats around the world, listening to and even jamming with whales. He writes about his experience in Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. And I'm pleased to welcome David Rothenberg back to Soundcheck. David, welcome.
Thanks for inviting me back.
Why whales? I mean, a whole book and an accompanying CD all surrounding this cetaceous music. What's the interest here?
Well, just listen to that sound you just played. Don't you want to join in? Doesn't it make you want to play along?
Well, clearly for you, that was the reaction. What can people get out of this project?
Well, before this, you know, I wrote a book called Why Birds Sing.
Right, the last time you were here. So this interspecies thing seems to be a theme.
Yeah, I like
you.
The idea of making music with beings we don't totally understand. You know, that's why I'm a jazz musician, because, you know, jazz musicians are very hard to figure out unless you play along with them. And often you're playing with people you can't otherwise communicate with. And so why not try it with birds? And after birds, whose songs are well known to people all over the world throughout history, immediately I thought of whales, whose songs were unknown until the 1960s. So I was interested in the whole history, what happened when these songs were discovered by Roger Payne and Scott McVeigh, the end of the 60s. What happened? How did people respond to these amazing songs? And then how did people play along with it? And what could happen today with the latest technologies? Could I make different kind of music along with these whales?
All right, well, different. I'll ask you to answer your own question then. Could you, with the new technology, travel around and make music with whales?
I'd say it's easier today, yes. You can get smaller underwater speakers and microphones and things, and you can go out there and get your sound down into that underwater environment.
So the idea was that you would lower not only a microphone to capture any whale sounds, but you would lower a speaker as well so that your clarinet playing could be heard.
That's
underwater.
Right. The whales have to hear me as I hear them, and I'm listening with headphones on to the whole underwater sound world down there.
And did it work?
Absolutely. I think in the best, you know, a lot of times it doesn't work. So something's going to go wrong. The whales will move away. There'll be too much wind. The boat will drift away. In the best cases, I really sensed that these humpback whales were changing their song in reaction to what I was doing. They were interacting with the clarinet in what at least I thought was a musical way.
All right, so let's hear a little bit from the CD that accompanies David Rothenberg's book called Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. All right, David Rothenberg, this is live? This is you and a whale live?
Absolutely, and that's the important thing, that it is live. It's not something made up in the studio. This is me playing live along with the whale.
Why does your clarinet sound like that?
It's underwater. This is what it sounds like underwater. This is what the guy on the BBC said the other day. He goes, doesn't really sound like a clarinet's supposed to sound, does it?
So it's not that the clarinet's underwater, but the
the recording is made from underwater.
Right? Okay. David Rothenberg is the author of the book and the accompanying CD called Thousand Mile Song, and we are also joined by Scott McVeigh, who is, in fact, one of the scientists who played a key role in getting the sounds of humpback whales out to the world in the 60s. He's also a conservationist and a poet. And speaking of poetry, Scott, David calls his book Thousand Mile Song. Is he taking some poetic license there?
No, it's actually a brilliant title, because if you can imagine a world before we had ships and all the incredible noise that human activity produces, the whales make sounds. They're low-frequency sounds that travel across, for example, the entire Atlantic Ocean. And this means, for example, with a blue whale, with low frequencies that are so low that you really only feel them with your body when you're in the water, but you can't quite hear them. They're like at 10 hertz or 15 hertz. A blue whale's sound carries across the entire Atlantic. And the fin whale, 10 feet shorter, the second biggest whale, makes also a low-frequency sound almost as low, and that's also almost beyond our capacity for hearing. In the case of the song of the humpback whale, which can be anywhere from 7 to 30 minutes long and then repeats a 6-octave song and so on, the lower frequency of those sounds can travel across great distances. The high frequency dissipates in a short distance. Sound travels 5 times as fast underwater as it does in air. So that you can imagine, before our species became active in the Atlantic Ocean, most of the big whales knew where all of the other whales were.
That's amazing. And the songs, first of all, we're all using this word song. Is that the proper term?
That is the right term. And indeed, the whale song is really not a lot different from a bird song, except that a bird song is often a minute or two or even less. And these songs go on, and they're sung. We did not know this at the time that Roger and I published our paper in Science, but these songs are made only by males, and all of the males are singing the same song at a given time. And this is in the case of the Northern Hemisphere, this would be off Bermuda, mm-hmm. or Puerto Rico, in the Atlantic, or in the Pacific, it'd be off Hawaii or off the Mexican coast. And it turns out that the song in the Pacific, the identical song is sung off the Mexican coast as off Hawaii. And they just, how they do this so many miles apart is rather amazing. It could be that they catch up in the summertime off the southeast coast of Alaska.
Wow. So there's like a whole, it's like a culture that with subcultures and dialects and stuff like that.
Actually, that choice of words is now acceptable. Ever since the work of Hal Whitehead, an extraordinary mathematical biologist, a Brit who's working up at Dalhousie University in Halifax, he has done the great work on the sperm whale. That's the biggest brain on Earth, 18, 20-pounder. We have just 3 pounds, and boy, does that show.
And we use, what, 3 ounces of that?
No, we're probably in overdrive trying to do the best we can. But it's interesting, if you look at, for example, the phonations of orca, the killer whale so-called, it turns out that's a 9-pound brain. Similarly, the elephant brain is a 9-pound brain and the largest brain on land, and we're number 2 with 3 pounds. I brought together the 2 leading people on this, Cynthia Moss from Africa, who had worked now 30 years plus on elephants in the Serengeti, with Paul Spong, who's adequately acknowledged in David's book. And it turned out they gave the identical lecture. It turns out they're both matriarchies. There's very little violence.
So in fact, culture is, as you say, now an acceptable word.
But the culture really comes in more strongly in the examination of click coatus by Hal Whitehead and his wife, Linda Weigert. They have examined sperm whales off Sri Lanka, the Galapagos off the coast of Chile, and they found that these click codas relate to different parts of the ocean. And he published an incredible book in 2003, published by the Chicago University Press.
So this, when David Rothenberg, you actually use some of these clicks in some of the musical material that accompanies the book.
That's right. It's important to realize each whale species is like a world unto itself. Sperm whales, like Moby Dick, make these clicking sounds. Most of them are regular clicks to find their prey. And then they make these irregular ones, the codas, which are not always at the end, but they call them codas. And through careful study of these irregular clicks, like really faint things, you know, on the recordings that Hal Whitehead has, he was able to determine that these are indicative of a kind of culture among groups of these whales. Years of travel on boats across the Pacific it took to get this data. And it's quite amazing that it's from these kind of almost imperceptible clicks that the idea of culture in whales got its strongest evidence and is now accepted.
And somewhat inevitably, perhaps, you chose to call the recording of these clicks on the CD that accompanies the book Moby Click. Let's hear a little bit from the CD that comes with David Rothenberg's book, Thousand Mile Song. He's with us, as well as the scientist and conservationist Scott McVeigh, and this is some music from the sperm whale. That is David Rothenberg playing the clarinet, bass clarinet in this piece. And on the piece called Moby Click, your percussion accompaniment is provided by sperm whale, these clicks that they produce.
This piece, unlike the first one, this is a studio creation where I took a recording of these clicks and sort of resonated them, created this rhythm. But I did want to create a rhythm that wasn't really a human-sounding rhythm, but that... You know, maybe it's like with the sperm whales here, because obviously these clicks mean a lot more to them than they mean to us. So they might have this large, resonating, important kind of sound.
David Rothenberg is author of Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. And Scott McVeigh, Scott, you and Roger Payne did some of those groundbreaking recordings, especially of humpback whale songs back in the 60s. Can you kind of tell us a little bit about how that happened and the impact that it had, surprisingly, on the world of pop culture?
The paper that we published in Science is based on the recordings of Frank Watlington at Bermuda. He was working at a SOFAR station for the Navy, tracking Soviet vessels off the coast of Africa. And he picked up this stuff and he made some tapes. He gave the tapes to Roger. Roger, in turn, gave the tapes to me because I'd done a lot of analysis of dolphin sounds when I worked with John Lilly in his laboratory down in Coconut Grove, Florida for a couple of years. And Roger was also aware of my paper in Scientific American that kind of provided the baseline evidence for what was happening to the whale stocks.
So this was part and parcel of the whole kind of conservation movement, Save the Whales.
Well, I would have to say that the song became the anthem for whale conservation and for conservation writ large. And Carl Sagan took these tapes and put them on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 that carried to the outer edge of our solar system and beyond. It was a package of only 198 pounds, but we were very happy to have those whale tapes on there as evidence of possible intelligence on Earth.
And what about, I mean, whales became like rock stars, you know? The record sold as many copies as Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Well, the interesting thing is that I always felt that as we learned more about species and their wondrous ways, that we'd be less inclined to destroy them. And so we saw this as an important move. And it turned out that artists and musicians in particular really picked up on this, because artists have antenna that go beyond what the everyday one of us walking along, and they would use this. And Roger in particular gave the tapes to Alan Hovhaannis, who wrote a work, And God Created the Great Whale, that lives on, is played regularly to this day. We were at the premiere performance. He gave them to Judy Collins, and she put them in her Teriwaki piece that became quite well known.
And Paul Winter as well.
Yeah, Paul Winter, with whom I've been happy to have worked for a very long period of time. We brought him to the Dodge Poetry Festival at our very first one in 86, and he's been at this biennial festival every year. But also when I was at Chautauqua, I brought Paul in, and he did six new recordings with other species of creature.
Right, wolves and loons, yeah, and things like that. Now, let me ask you about these recordings. The recordings made in the 60s and 70s, this, David, is one of the kind of weirder ideas that posited in your book. And since you're here, Scott, I'll ask you about this. The recordings of whales in the 60s and 70s, are these the superstars, and are the youth whales of today not living up to the standard of the good old days?
Well, Roger, who has worked on this really all his life in one way or another, has said that the Frank Wildington tapes, the songs they're on, are the strongest that he's ever heard. Now, Roger is also a cellist and a musician, on top of being a undergraduate in biology at Harvard, and then working at Cornell, and on the sounds that owls make, pick up on it with regard to mice on the ground. But Roger has said that these are the strongest songs from that period. But the point is that the song evolves so that in a given year, there'll be some new elements introduced, and there'll be some elements deleted, so that after a period of 4, 5, or 6 years, we've got a totally different song. And this will happen in all the locations where songs are heard.
Wow. So it's sort of like an oral tradition, I mean, like folk music, human folk music, where every time there's a David, having done some folk music yourself, you know how it works. With each iteration, the song is slightly different.
Well, what's amazing is that it's unlike any other animal that we know of, that they change their songs from year to year as a group. And what's especially unusual is they all want to sound the same. They want to sing the same song, but they still change it. So somehow an innovation is introduced. We're not exactly sure how. Maybe one whale gets an idea. Maybe it's just genetically programmed to change, and then they all pick up on the change. Well, now, whether it's worse today, you know, I think that's more a question of what pop music you like. You know, I think Roger knows these recordings well, but today the whales are singing differently. It still sounds like whale song, and they're still pretty cool. And there's better quality recordings today, of course. You have better technology, so the fidelity is different. I think they're still the new ones are good. You know, they're different.
They work
style
for you.
Going on. Yeah.
All right. We're speaking with David Rothenberg, who is author of the book and the accompanying CD, Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound, and Scott McVeigh, who, along with the aforementioned Roger Payne, one of the scientists who first brought the sounds of recorded whale song to the public consciousness back in the late 60s. So, David, at one point you found some orcas off of, was it Vancouver Island?
Mm-hmm.
And recorded your clarinet. Now, is this also a live duet, or is this another studio
Depends
piece?
Depends which piece you're going to play.
The Killer.
The Killer is a studio one.
And here's a little bit of it. So what's happening here? You made the recording of the whale first and then overdubbed?
Well, these are the sounds of the particular culture of killer whales that eat mammals, mammal-eating killer whales. They're called transients up there. The resident whales only eat fish, and they're more studied and more friendly.
Right,
these eat mammals, so there's a certain melancholy, this mammal-eating sounds.
So this is the whale version of punk rock, I guess. The Killer is the name of the track.
Thank you.
The Killer is a track from the CD that accompanies David Rothenberg's Thousand Mile Song, a book about whale music. And boy, you know, David, that whale really does sound kind of melancholy. Sad that he has to resort to eating his fellow mammals.
It's one of the choices in life you can make. Take the mammal-eating path.
Scott McVeigh, I have to ask, can we make any kind of reasonable, educated guess as to what these songs mean to the whales?
Well, the working supposition for many years was that once it had been determined that these were males that were singing, that this was a song to catch the attention of the female. The surprising thing in the 40 years since we did this work is that we do not have a single evidence of the slightest response of a female humpback whale. Now, this doesn't mean it couldn't be happening at night when it's inconvenient for us.
Maybe that's why there aren't enough whales.
Well, actually, so the other supposition is that it has something to do with the definition of relationships among the males. And it could be, you know, that Caruso, singing the same song, has an edge on others.
So there is, again, this question of culture, of song as an aspect of a whale-based culture. David, having collaborated with birds and whales, you have made time for the occasional human, and Pete Seeger, although not on the disc, his shadow sort of looms large over at least a portion of this project.
That's right, because in my research to find all the pop songs written in response to the discovery of this song, there are so many. We mentioned Judy Collins already. We had Country Joe and the Fish, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Later, Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed both did whale-based songs. There's even an entire episode of The Partridge Family where they save the whales. And so it was out there. But one of the earliest and most talked or written about songs was one by Pete Seeger. There's a lot of newspaper articles mentioning it. But I was amazed to discover, looking around online, I found the lyrics, but it said the song had never been recorded by anybody. And the lyrics were actually about recording the whale song. So Pete must have really been there. He must have heard the story. And he lives near, I do, in the Hudson Valley. So I called him up and said, "What? You know, you never recorded this song? Let's record it today." He goes, No. I'm too old to sing any of my old songs. You know, you have to do it." So I can't sing. I said, "Well, anyone can sing." And I remember he had said the same thing to me in elementary school when he came to my school and dragged me up on stage. So I got out there and tried to do it, along with the background rhythms of these largest, lowest whales you mentioned earlier, the blue and the fin whales, all sped up and the pitch raised up so you can hear these rhythms and these beats, the kind that could travel all the way across the oceans.
So in the background of this piece, the blue whales, the fin whales, and as Scott McVeigh was telling us earlier, sounds that are naturally too low for us to really hear as music, but you speed them up a bit and you can sort of perceive those rhythms. David Rothenberg singing this Pete Seeger song over those rhythms. The song is called "The World's Last Whale." And the book is called "Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound" by David Rothenberg, working very much on the shoulders of Scott McVeigh and Roger Payne, who brought these sounds to us in the 60s. Scott, David, a real pleasure to have both of you with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
Early last spring, near an underwater mountain where the humpbacks sing.
1 minute.
I lowered a microphone.
Stay tuned for Soundcheck's CD Picks of the Week coming up next. And then coming up after that, violinist James Ennis is one of the hottest classical musicians in Canada. He'll join us for a live performance of some music by Bach here in our Soundcheck studio.